So, hello everyone. Thank you again for downloading this new episode of Meet the Maquonics. I'm delighted today to have Professor Simon Benjamin from the University of Oxford and the NQIT, Network Quantum Information Technologies Hub, in the UK, to talk today about what's going on in England and what's going on probably more broadly in Europe, and specifically what's going on with research at Oxford. So, Simon, thanks for joining me.
Well, thanks a lot for having me on.
So generally, as I usually try and start these things off, as most people would know, is just a little bit of a bio of yourself and how you got into this and sort of what motivated you to move into quantum research and quantum technology development.
Sure. Well, I've been in Oxford for a long time now. I did my doctorate here. And in that time, Oxford was one of the relatively few big efforts on quantum computing. Of course, we have David Deutsch here, and we have Arthur Eckert at that time was leading a big quantum research center. Mm-hmm. And my own stuff was not at that point quantum computing, but I was talking to those guys, also people like Wim Van Dam and Mike Mosca, and just getting really interested in it. And I just got inspired. It's very exciting to think that you could be part of the effort to create what might well be the ultimate computer, and the thought that the computers we have today, supercomputers even, as powerful and amazing as they are not using and not really harnessing nature fully, and that there is a whole other layer that we can be harnessing, which can we can show do amazing things that regular computers cannot. And so as someone who's interested in physics, someone who's interested in computing, someone who's interested in the future of humanity and technology, what else would you do except quantum computing research, right? Now, yeah. I've always been a bit of a risk around the laboratory. I mean, you know, it's likely to set your research back if you invite me into the lab because my elbows go in the wrong place and, you know, knock something out of alignment. So it's obvious to me that if I was going to contribute, it would need to be on the theory side. But I've always tried to keep my theory pretty close to experiments. So I've had the privilege of working with a lot of experimental groups on protocols and ideas and architectures, I think very similar to your own interests. Just trying to, you know, help figure out how we're going to make these things and how we're going to use them for useful stuff.
So I think it must be something about people called Simon.
Yeah, right. I don't know. We need check out the meaning of the name. But I think that's basically it. I got, you know, it didn't take me long to get really hooked on the idea of working in quantum computing. And I certainly don't regret it. Actually, I think, and I'm sure you're likely to agree with me here, it's more exciting times than ever right now in quantum computing, because we're seeing a lot of ideas that have been on paper or in very small demonstration experiments for a long time. We're seeing those ideas, you know, being achieved, or big efforts to actually achieve them. So it's, you know, it seems to be kind of a flowering of the field right now. Mm-hmm.
I'm interested just on your own personal history. I mean, I came up through the CQCT in Australia, and obviously they were sort of pioneering silicon and a lot of stuff in linear mm-hmm. optics, and being mm-hmm. the same as you, being a theorist who's generally not welcome in a laboratory space. You know, I still always came at it, even though it was a theoretical point of view, but was very much interested in sort of the practical interests and which systems would work. I mean, how did you sort of really get into this? Was it, I think I know how to build it out of these kind of systems, or were you more sort of on the information theory side or the algorithm side or something a little bit more abstract?
Right. I mean, I guess I do try and interest myself in a range of stuff these days, and the people in my group do work on ways to have more robust algorithms and so on. But my own way into it was really quite concretely trying to think about which systems would make good quantum computers. And, you know, the early days were quite Wild West in that there were, and I guess there still are, a huge range of ideas for what's the hardware going to be that at the base level forms your quantum computer. It's fascinating because it clearly cannot be conventional transistors. The way that conventional computing has progressed does not lead you to a quantum computer, which is sometimes a misunderstanding. People think that as things get smaller and smaller, you some sort of naturally become a quantum computer, and that's wrong. You need to, if you want to, rather than suppress quantum effects, harness them, you need to work very differently. So I've worked on a lot of different approaches, including, let's say, molecular structures, that the idea there is to assemble molecular structures and choose molecules, like one is called N-C60, which is a buckyball with an atom in the middle of it that mm-hmm. might make qubits, and you know, all sorts of ideas. And I've tried to have a look at all the different schemes that seem to be sort of front runners, including all optical computing and things like that. But what I eventually settled on as being the approach that I found most inspiring is the idea of combining the best of both worlds between what I would call matter systems, which and we can say what those might be, but an example is an ion trap, and optical systems to link them up. And that's really quite similar, I suppose, to how we get our high performance computers to work these days. We have you know, we have a processor on a certain scale that we can build, and then when we want to go larger than that, we link them with fibers. And I think that the same paradigm, very roughly, is a nice one for quantum computing, because it allows you to think in terms of how are you going to build that small structure that is a very nice little quantum computer, maybe so small that it's not powerful in its own right and can't do more than, you know, a laptop, or much far less, you know, it can't be more powerful than a laptop, but you link them. You've got the, you know, you've got that kind of hierarchy or structure where you've got linkage, and then, you know, it's very bad to say just when you're referring to quantum technologies, which are immensely challenging, whatever you try to do, but still just need to plug more and more of those little entities in, whatever that individual entity is. Could be an ion trap, could be an NV center, could even potentially be a superconducting system if you can figure out how to get a wire essentially out of a Dilfridge and back down into another Dilfridge, you know, with the problem that the link would then come up to room temperature.
Right. So you kind of preempted my next question a little bit as to sort of, you know, what, given your expertise and certainly given the research papers that you focused on the last couple of years, is to what has become your system of choice. Now, you mentioned that it's more of a general concept of being sort of a more matter-based system that is optically connected, simply to ease scalability. But you have done a lot of work on ion trap systems. And I know, sort of leading into what we're going to talk about with NQIT, that has turned into one of the systems of choices that's being developed at Oxford and within the hub more in general. So is ion trap sort of the matter-based system that you're sort of locking on to?
I think that it's fair to say that it is, but not to the extent that I'm not also very interested in trying to be useful to the efforts that look at other matter-based systems. I don't think it's clear yet which is the way to go. But if I had to put my money on one system, at the moment I would choose ion traps. That is to say, if I was trying to choose a entity that can be a module in this kind of network picture, then an ion trap can be a very nice choice, because ion traps have superb levels of control within an ion trap device. They are, in fact, the best controlled qubits of any kind, with the world record. Okay, so as you'll know, and I dare say many of your listeners will, the thing that's usually hardest inside a quantum computer is to make a more than one qubit, but let's say a two-qubit gate, because you can't have a computer unless the components are able to talk to each other and influence each other's behavior. Otherwise, you just have a memory, right? So the two-qubit gate is usually the gnarly one. And in ion traps, the fidelity, the performance level of two-qubit gates is in excess of 99.9%. Mm-hmm. And that is higher than can be achieved with superconducting systems, far higher than has so far been achieved in most other systems. So it's got the performance there, but it also has the optical to come out of an ion conditional on the state of that ion. And in fact, then the photon and the ion can be entangled with each other. And this allows you to then think about how you're going to bridge between one device and another using the photon flying along a fiber.
And there was also, wasn't there a recent result in Nature from your colleagues at Oxford about speeding up the gates of ion
traps?
That's
right. So one of the weaknesses of ion traps, weakness is too strong a word, but one of the ways in which you might score, for example, superconducting qubits more highly, is that the gates, the two-qubit gates, have tended to be slow. So there has been an effort to speed them up, and they've succeeded in speeding them up tremendously while still maintaining these or almost maintaining these very high fidelity levels. So you're still at record-breaking fidelities. Another thing which has been very important to achieve, and again has been an achievement in the last couple of years, has been to trap more than one species of ion. Because if all your ions in your trap are the same thing, for example, all calcium, then it's very difficult to talk to one of those calcium ions without at least weakly talking to another one. Because the laser only focuses to a finite amount. And actually, if you want to worry about very high fidelity operations, and the single qubit gates that ion traps in Oxford have achieved have been six nines of precision. It's just a pretty amazing number if you think about it. One part in a if you want that kind of thing with laser control in a system with multiple ions, you have to worry about such rare events as the ion that you're talking to spits out a photon, and that photon just happens to hit another ion that's inside the same device, even though the cross-section for that will be tiny. That kind of thing will limit you. But if you have more than one species of ion in your trap, it gives you tremendous freedom in terms of how you're going to control the thing. And that, together with the idea of having different zones in your traps, you can move ions backwards and forwards, gives you the capacity then to have an extremely high fidelity object as long as it doesn't have too many ions in it. And of course, that's where we would not seek to put a very large number of ions in a trap. There are people working on those kind of ideas, but instead we'd say, let's build a module that's a really fantastic little quantum computer under wonderful levels of control, and then let's figure out how to link it to other modules.
And that's been certainly the focus of most of the papers that I read in stupendous amount of detail from you. But since you're a theorist, I mean, we have to ask a little bit more of the abstract as to where, when you're meeting with people, when you're talking to funders or government agency or just other scientists, as to where you see the most optimism in where the quantum technology can head maybe in the next 10 or 15 years in terms of, applications, in terms of our ability to scale up and, that their fundamental use beyond being, a nice little toy to play with online or some interesting articles that we read in the press.
Yeah, I mean, you could argue that quantum computers are already performing an important task for us, which is that they are allowing us to do science and nature papers, right? And that's a pretty important product. If you're a scientist, that your computer is working if it's allowing you to produce science and nature papers.
Very true.
But what I think you and I and I think most people who are actively involved with really producing a scalable quantum computer want to see is we want to see these devices becoming useful and important outside of physics, at least reaching as far as, let's say, the chemistry department in your university, and other people who are, facing other kinds of problems and aren't necessarily interested in how the quantum computer works. They just want to know that there's a new tool available that will allow their research or their problems to be resolved more quickly. And I think it's not unreasonable to hope that we are on the cusp of that happening. So I think there's two kinds of quantum computer you could envisage for the sort of for the next few years, I think. There's a quantum computer which is designed to be big enough to do interesting problems, and that quantum computer will, it doesn't matter in a sense how big it is, as long as it's big enough to physically be able to process problems that are meaningful. For example, to a chemist who wants to be able to predict whether a reaction will happen or not in, as it were, software rather than having to do trial and error. And if indeed one could produce such a machine, it would clearly supercharge the research progress in chemistry and therefore perhaps drug discovery or material science and so on. That doesn't matter how big that machine is. It doesn't matter if it fills a warehouse, as long as it gets the job done. But then, so certainly you would have to scale from where we are now into at least, probably hundreds of qubits in order to see those things achieved and perhaps much more. But then, if you look at conventional computing, you can see that we do have supercomputers which people run big important problems on using pretty much the entire facility for some number of days at a time. But that's not what most of the computer facilities around the world do. That's not what most Google server farms and so on do. Instead, they are collections of computers that work on multiple problems from multiple users simultaneously. And that's the only way that you're going to actually have a computer that's in some sense important for society, mm-hmm. is if you can solve problems for multiple businesses or even end users simultaneously in some facility. And if you want that, it's not enough to have one quantum computer any more than it's enough to have one chip inside a Google server farm. You better have an entire facility that, you know, is for economies of scale is in one place, but it's actually loads of computers. And then you need to think which of the technologies that you're interested in could potentially, let's say, put a quantum computer on a chip or something like that, so that in due course you can have a facility with a lot of those things. And that's, you know, that's a second level of the concept of scaling. So we need to go from the little devices we have in the lab, which aren't actually useful yet, scale them into at least hundreds of qubits, maybe thousands or more, so that they can do a useful task. And then there's some kind of next generation scaling problem where we say, well, really, I want all of that in a small device so that I can have loads of such machines and be working on, you know, a ton of problems at once. And actually, you know, if then I have a machine learning task or something that's helpful to the general public, I can actually have the infrastructure for that.
So that's interesting, because certainly you and I have over the years worked on very, very similar topics in regards to scalability and general yeah. quantum architectures. And it's very cool that you said something like that, because it actually leverages into sort of what I would consider the next even level talk about scalability, which is cost.
Oh, yeah.
Because
right.
It's a question of optimism as to whether or not there's something commercially viable at 1,000 physical qubits or 10,000, especially considering the constraints of error correction. You know, we might actually be talking about millions to tens of millions before we can yeah. actually run algorithms, which means if we're talking about $100 or $1,000 per qubit, we've got another potential problem on our hands. So
that's right.
How much of the stuff that you work with and the discussions that you have talk about the idea of, it's not only getting a qubit that works, it's not even getting yeah. a qubit that works at the required fidelities that we need, but it's also yeah. a qubit that you can consider scaling to the yeah. point where it might be $1 or $10 per qubit.
Yeah, exactly. And so that, I think, is the kind of second level scaling problem that I was alluding to, in that if you can get to thousands of qubits, which are under excellent levels of control, let's say where we are now or even a bit better, then I think, and this is certainly unproven, but I think you will find that machine can do useful things for you. Perhaps, for example, on the chemistry side, it will be also an amazing device to start to explore what quantum algorithms can do. Because, of course, at the moment, we don't have very many useful quantum algorithms worked out, but that's because we're having to work out stuff, as it were, on paper without having the machine to play with. And, you know, a lot of amazing discoveries in conventional computing have come essentially because people have access to machines to try stuff out. There was Hinton, who's one of the fathers of the whole machine learning, deep learning revolution, gave a talk that I was listening to, and he explained that one of his key breakthroughs came from just thinking, well, this won't work, but I'll be interested to see what does happen. And he just tried it and it worked wonderfully, right? So that is, humans have only a limited ability to intuit their way to amazing algorithms realistically. And in the quantum regime, that's harder than ever because of the difficulty of internalizing the necessary concepts. So having a machine that we can play with and that goes well beyond our simulations is going to be crucial to getting the next generation of software, even if to run that software at its full potential indeed needs millions of qubits. So there is an enormous value in being able to build a machine that's, say, in the thousands or tens of thousands, even smaller than that, sort of scale. There's enormous value in getting 100 qubits. But I think I agree with you that the full potential of quantum computing needs you to be able to see how you're going to get tens of millions or more qubits. And at that point, your cost, your marginal cost per qubit better be pretty small, right? And it's an open question whether some of the so ion traps, for example, it's very clear to me that they can form optically linked ion traps, can be that first generation machine, that facility. You could imagine it's a sort of a national facility or something that you put a big effort into, a little bit like in high energy particle physics or fusion research and so on. You build this thing and it accelerates progress, and it's a, in you know, it's an incredible asset to have, but it isn't yet the mature form of the technology. Now, whether optically linked ion traps can actually bring the cost per qubit down to the sort of numbers you're talking about, I would say we just don't know, because it hasn't been attempted to you know, manufacture en masse, let's say, little enclosed vacuum modules with ion traps inside them. How much would that have to cost? Well, there's no reason that it would have to cost an immense amount. It doesn't use, you know, an extraordinarily rare material or anything like that. But you would have to drop orders of magnitude out of the current cost, which is, of course, the bespoke laboratory cost. So I do think it's interesting to explore other approaches which manifestly, because of the way they're designed, should have a low per qubit cost, I think, so that we have options when it comes to building the really large scale, which is still small by comparison to conventional computers in terms of the, you know, the bit count or qubit count, but which can give us that full potential.
I mean, one of the things I haven't thought about too much, but I certainly see it as a problem, maybe you've thought about it a little bit more, is I agree with you that the being able to provide a machine that has, you know, a sufficient number of qubits to be classically unsimulatable or classically non-trivial would help spur algorithmic development. But considering the fact that, you know, the reason we need error correction is because, you know, we can't push experimentalists too hard. You know, an error rate of 0.1% per qubit per gate operation is already incredibly difficult to achieve. So that kind of limits us, doesn't it, when we're talking about, say, 1,000 qubits or 1,500 qubits from doing anything with those qubits if we can't simultaneously get the error rates down. Because as soon as we incorporate error correction, all our resources go through the roof, and we need to fabricate another 500,000 of them before we can sort of replicate the same thing, but with at least a little bit of error correction.
Yeah, no, I mean, that is, I think, where applied theorists should be putting their effort right now, is exactly on that question. And I think that's a commonly held view, to judge by the number of conferences that are popping up and, you know, papers that are sort of addressing exactly this question. So it's fascinating to reflect that the threshold for when your quantum computer may be doing things that are useful comes when you can no longer mimic what it would do using a conventional supercomputer, right? Because any smaller than that, and you may as well use the conventional supercomputer. And that threshold has been given the phrase or been given the name quantum supremacy, which is, I think, a phrase that I found relatively few people who actually like that phrase. It's certainly attached. Its problem with the phrase quantum supremacy is that, it sounds a bit evil and racist, but that's not the deep problem with it. The deep problem with it is that it's an oversell of that point. Once you've got quantum computers that perhaps 60 qubits that are pretty well behaved, then you can't use a conventional supercomputer to really comprehensively predict what that thing is going to do. So you could say that's past the quantum supremacy threshold. But that machine, we have no idea how to do anything useful with a 60 qubit machine except generate even more nature and science papers. It might be that that machine is useful for some chemistry problem, but that has yet to be established. So the word supremacy is an enormous oversell for a device that we don't actually know, you know, how to use it for anything. Certainly it's not supreme versus your iPhone, which is far more useful. So I think that there's this fascinating gap, though, as you've alluded to, between that point at which quantum computers might be useful for something and the point when we know that they are definitely useful and we know how to get the job done, which I would say is around about something like 6 million qubits, just based on a paper by a couple of colleagues of mine, which is a surface code based approach where you assume good connectivity and you have magic state factories and all that good stuff, and end up needing to have something a bit more than 1,000 physical qubits per logical qubit. I guess it's a bit depressing to think that 1,000 qubits, 1,000 physical qubits, is vastly beyond the 50 qubit threshold for when things might get interesting. And yet, if you take the error correction approach, it's just one qubit, which is such a sort of sobering thing to reflect on.
And
but
sorry, what was the application that you guys looked at? Because I mean, the numbers that I've seen, yeah, puts us right in the middle of that, between 1 and 10 million qubits to get started.
So that wasn't my paper. That was a paper by Joe O'Gorman and Earl Campbell, and it's in PhysRev A. And that one was looking at, just because it's such a well-understood problem, it was looking at factoring, so factoring numbers. And they looked at factoring, a 1,000-bit, because that's well out of reach of classical computers that are about 760 on that, which obviously is an exponentially scaling problem. So they started at 1,000 as a sort of entry level, my quantum computer can do something amazing, and then they looked at scaling to 2 and 4,000 bit factoring. And that paper is actually a magic state distillation paper, looking at more efficient ways of doing magic state distillation. But and the paper is a challenging paper to understand, because it's got some very complex ideas. But what everybody can understand is what their table one, I think it is, in that paper, which just lists the size and running time of a quantum computer under various sort of presumptions. Using the architecture that they're suggesting. And the most optimistic category, which is an error rate that's a little bit lower than today's record-breaking error rates, comes out, as I recall, as 6 million qubits. 6 million physical qubits factor a 1,000-bit number, essentially. So, that's that one. And I think, you know, other people's analysis, as you suggest, sort of comes along the same lines, until you put in some more nasty constraints. For example, if you think you've got only nearest neighbor interactions, and if your errors are a bit more nasty, like heavy amounts of leakage error, where you escape from the qubit subspace, that might hit you, you know, worse. You might start heading towards a billion qubits once you start to put those kind of features in.
Yeah, well, now we're really talking about issues of scalability, which...
Yeah, right. It's not obvious how you do a billion qubits, right?
No, certainly not yet. And if it's going to be at least, even if it's a dollar a qubit, I mean, a billion qubits certainly poses a problem.
It does, you know. So I think that's why architectures are important. And I think that having, especially for the early computers, but even for these monsters that we hope we can create, well, monsters, these wonderful machines that we hope we can create in due course, the architecture matters. I think it actually, funnily enough, matters almost more for the relatively small scale machines. So you'll be familiar with this term that IBM researchers have put forward, quantum volume, which is an effort, and I applaud this. It's an effort to move away from just saying, how many qubits have you got, right? That's the question that you always get asked. How many qubits have you got? And that's a very valid question to ask, because until the answer is more than 50, you know you don't have a machine that can do anything unprecedented, because you could simulate it. And so how many qubits is a very important question. And you've also indicated that what do you think your eventual cost per qubit will be is another very important question. But because until you can suppress errors comprehensively, errors will always be a limiting factor, just as limiting in practice as not having enough qubits. Then quantum volume basically combines together how high quality your operations are and how many qubits you've got. And It's to basically put out this metric, because it's not what you'd expect a corporation to do, because quantum volume doesn't particularly promote the kind of superconducting grid structures which IBM are working on. It's a fair metric, and and that means that you know, it doesn't play exactly to their own strengths. And in particular, it emphasizes the need for high connectivity. Because if you are trying to work in this interesting regime where, as you've identified, we're not sure that anything will actually be useful, because the errors might overwhelm us. If we have a 100 qubit device even, and you think you've got something very interesting in, I don't know, chemistry simulation that you could do with 100 qubits, but if your error rate is not extremely small and you're not very clever about things, you're going to find that even 100 qubits with perhaps, I don't know, a few hundred gate operations, just leads to junk coming out at the other end because of error accumulation. So I think that quantum volume is very good to sort of measure that. And what you find is that if you put in a machine that has only a grid and nearest neighbor connectivity, you pay a brutal price, because your qubits that your algorithm wants to operate, your algorithm wants to say, oh, qubit number one should now have a gate operation with qubit number 27. But if number 1 and 27 are not adjacent to each other, and that and your machine works by adjacent links, you will now need to swap those qubits to, until, you know, keep shuffling them until they are sitting next to each other on the physical hardware. And that means that the error budget should not just be the error from the gate, but the error from all the swap operations that it took you to get into a position to do the gate. And if you're really pushing, you know, if your experimentalists have worked for 3 years to go from, you know, 3 nines to 4 nines or whatever, you're just going to throw, you basically throw that advance away because you've had to permute the qubits around. And that's why it's one of the reasons I'm a huge fan of the network-based approach where you use light to link things up. Because, again, using this famous sort of just, which is never just for the guys who have to build it, but still from the theorist's point of view, you just have to reroute the light so that qubit number 1 is talking to qubit number 23, and now next cycle, qubit number 1 can talk to number 58 directly by remapping the optical pathways, which is just a problem of going through optical switches.
No, but, I'm definitely on your side with that assessment.
Yeah. I think we're talking, you know, we're both on the, we don't have someone who, who can sort of advocate the, what I would call more monolithic and locally connected architecture. But so I think you and I are on the same page about that.
I certainly like the optical stuff, but, you know, as you know, I did some work with Winnie Hensinger down at Sussex, who's also part of NQIT on the more monolithic design for ion traps.
Yes, that's a very very interesting paper, and it got a lot of attention, I think, from the field and from beyond the field. That was the blueprint paper, right?
That was the blueprint paper, and I mean, I didn't follow up too much with Winnie after the paper was published. But I am interested in the context, and I don't follow ion trap, you know, internal discussions too much, as to how that was represented, or at least how it was received, I should say, simply because, as you say, the dominant assumption is with ion traps that you would want to go with optical connections. And I agree with you, there are substantially good reasons to go for optical connections at scale. But considering, especially in the ion trap case, that at least so far, the ion trap connections, while successful, are extremely slow. And there still is a little bit of work that needs to be done in order to get them up to speed, in order to make sure that your quantum computer actually is viable at scale. I don't know how much was that work with Winnie on the monolithic design, where we have no optical connections and just everything is fabricated and connected together. I mean, how is that starting to play out in sort of the discussion?
Well, I think, that is... There are really, as we're sort of using these words, and I hope we've explained them enough, a sort of network versus monolithic. And monolithic is essentially just building one big thing where your qubits are all within some kind of device. And that could be a giant chip inside a Dielfrich if it's superconducting qubits, you know. And indeed, that is where people are heading to achieve, say, a 7x7 grid, and they would hope to be able to go much larger. I think the novelty of the work that you did with Winnie was that there's no level at which you sort of say, okay, that's as big as we can go, and now we need to think about, you know, some other linking strategy. Whereas I think most people in most other areas, whether they think about a module with a very small number of qubits in it, you know, obviously one is enough if you can reliably link it to other modules. I think in practice you're going to want a few, like 5, so that you can do overcome the noise in the links. Whether you go for a very, let's say, granular network or a very chunky network, which would be more like the conventional computers we have today, where each module is a fully fledged processing engine, but you use links to go to the full scale that you need. But the interesting thing about Winnie's idea, or, you know, the idea that you guys collectively had also with Austin Fowler, right, if I remember. Who are the authors? Like, who am I missing off, or were there loads?
Oh, there was Klaus Malmer in Denmark, and there was Christian Wunderlicht in Germany. And then Winnie's group, Austin and me. Right.
Yes. So I think it is really interesting to just say, well, let's not assume that at some point in the future will solve the problem of connectivity and our modules, because our units will have got to a size, even if that size is 10,000 qubits, that we can't see how to scale it more, and then we'll solve the connectivity problem. Actually, maybe as an aside, I can say that that always worries me. If someone's plan for scaling is we'll go as big as we can and then we'll solve how to connect two up, because that's a very dangerous sort of breakpoint in your thinking. And there are two ways to avoid that, and I think the things we're talking about now are either end of the spectrum of how to avoid that. Either you go for a very granular network so that task one really is to show how two elements link up and to solve the problems which you alluded to, which are like the speed of the link. And those are solvable problems. The speed of the link is potentially megahertz. It's just that it's far lower in more like the 10 hertz range in lab experiments to date because of engineering problems, essentially fierce ones, but solvable ones to do with the light not going where you want it to and instead get lost. So if indeed you want a fast sort of in your mature technology, you want a really fast machine that's megahertz or higher, then you need to solve those problems and maybe put a cavity across your ion trap, which is a really interesting challenge with some physics in it and a lot of engineering in it. But there's nothing in physics to say you can't do that. On the contrary, you can do that. We just can't do it yet. But so one way to avoid saying, I'm just going to go bigger and bigger, but I know I won't be able to go big enough in a monolithic device. So when I get to that point, I'll solve the challenge of connecting two or more up. If you don't like the sound of that because it sounds like a nasty risk, an unknown risk in the future, you either solve connectivity on day one, as it were, or you know, task one, by saying I'll have small devices and it's all about the connectivity, or you go to the other end and you say, no, I'm going to figure out how to have a single device that does not need to be broken into pieces and linked up. It just is big enough to be the entire story. But I think the challenges of the latter seem to be just achieving enough control of all the things you need, including the sort of passive things like having a high grade, an extremely high grade vacuum that now has to sit over, you know, an enormous structure and be maintained. And all the control circuitry, which you need to bring in, you no longer can relax and say, okay, my control system is 10 times bigger than my qubit device itself. It needs to wrap the qubit device itself. But that's okay because my device only needs to be a certain size. And as long as a fiber comes out of it, I'm good. And I don't really care whether it, you know, whether it's 10 centimeters or a meter to the next device. That's the luxury that you have if you go with a network approach. Instead, if you're going monolithic on large scale, you need to keep putting those vast amounts of control system, focus them into where the actual structure lives in such a way that you aren't disrupting the, you know, the fidelity or speed of your operations. So I think it's really interesting to see that end of the architectural spectrum mapped out. And I think that it's not the approach that I advocate, as you know, but I think it's really valuable to have that in the literature and indeed to have someone trying seriously to achieve it, which I believe Winnie is, you know what I mean?
No, I think he is.
That is his agenda now, is to realize the components and then that device. And as with everyone in the field, even the areas where I've been kind of critical, I wish everybody good luck. I mean, what I really want to see happen is a quantum computer created, right? And so if you told me that we'd have a quantum computer in X years and that we'd be able to use it, and but that the way it was realized is not the particular one that I think right now is the way to go, then I would be just happy to hear that the thing works and that we've got it, you know. And I think that in a sense, everybody is, in hindsight, it might seem that only the researchers who are involved in the particular approach that quote unquote wins are the ones that have contributed. But of course, that's wrong, because we don't know what is the correct way to build a quantum computer. Everybody who's having a serious go at that and has the, you know, the skills and the willpower and energy to try and make it happen are all equally contributing to the eventual success that we will see. But yeah, for my money, it's the granular network. And I've thought about that, you know, a great deal, as I know you have. And I hope I'm not hostile to any particular approach. I'm simply critical. And I'm critical of the network approach too. The need to eventually have very fast links is an important one, for example. Although
no,
not, I think.
I think these approaches are absolutely fantastic to go through. I mean, the whole idea, again, specifically on the ion trap designs, as to whether or not you go monolithic or whether you go sort of the more networked idea, is what is the bigger engineering challenge? Is the bigger engineering challenge to, you know, have a very large vacuum system that houses everything, You control everything in some monolithic structure. Or as you say, with the optical connections, they're not great now, but they're, you know, appears to be no problem except for engineering to get the rates up to megahertz.
Exactly. But I will say this for the difference between the approaches, and this is something we'd already touched on. The connectivity is better in a network picture, and that means if you can achieve with a monolithic approach, I don't know, whatever number you like, 200 qubits for the sake of a number, and you can achieve that with a network approach, but the network approach has high, practically in such a small device, you could pretty much do all-to-all connectivity. That is going to give you a very nice advantage because you will not need to spend any time permuting qubits around and attracting errors because of that. You can directly link things. The thing that the theorist draws on the whiteboard as a circuit diagram, her design is just going to be directly realizable with the hardware. And I think that that means that while you might still say it's the jury's out on how to build a 6 million or more qubit machine and whether you should go monolithic or a granular network or chunky network, for the near future machines, I'd much rather have access to a network machine than a monolithic machine because of just the advantage of connectivity when you're fighting errors.
Yeah, I'd actually fully 100% agree with you on that. Some systems don't allow for it, which is unfortunate, but no, I agree in the principle that that would be ideal if we could get to that. But
well,
I suppose I was just going to basically start talking about, because we've basically been talking about 40 minutes now, just on the more abstract stuff. And I did want to include a little bit sort of a level of promotion for the hubs and NQIT specifically. So correct me if I'm wrong, but NQIT is the largest of the UK quantum technology hubs. Is that correct?
It is. Well, it depends how you measure it. But I think that in terms of the sort of financial side of things, we probably are the largest. We're at about 40 million. So NQIT, which you can say, you can pronounce, but we try to get people to call it NKIT and not NQIT, just because the word quit isn't.
Exactly.
We're told that NKIT is a positive thing because kit means, you know, like your sports equipment or your lab equipment or something. Mm-hmm. It's empowering. So we call it NKIT. And so NKIT, which everyone can find out about, by the way, at just nqit.org. And there's a lot of good stuff we have there, including a movie about the scalable ion trap approach.
Oh, I saw that. That was quite cool.
It's not bad, is it? It's a nice explainer video, I hope, and fun to watch. And it kind of gets more interesting, so you should keep watching it. Even initially, it's just a couple of ions, and you're like, all right, I'm bored of looking at these ions. But we get pretty funky if you watch it 2 minutes long. But so NKIT is this very nice, very well-funded. We're very, I think the UK is funding quantum technology at a high level. As of course, you know, Australia is, and various other countries are prioritizing it. And the investment got split into four different hubs that range from very practical things like sensors and imaging through communications to the sort of, let's say, the longer range goal, but perhaps the most disruptive thing, which is the quantum computing. And NKIT is the quantum computing hub. So we've been going for, 3.5 years now. And well, a bit less, but so we're well into it. It's a 5-year program, although we expect that many of the goals will take longer than that to fully realize. So we expect, further extension of the hub structure so that they can continue to do what they're doing. And what they're doing is very exciting, which is bringing in loads of companies, not just the ones they started with. We started with about 30 companies supporting us. So nearly half the money was in one way or another resources committed by companies. And since then, we've had partnerships with many more on every scale, from little companies that practically are startups and are just interested in how quantum can be a major part of their offering, through to the titans like Google and Lockheed Martin and so on. So it's an industry-facing academic alliance of 9 universities led by Oxford with the aim of bringing about useful quantum computing, essentially. And the thing we've talked about, the optically linked ion traps, are one of the approaches. Let's say I would call it the flagship sort of the thing we're trying to achieve that's our sort of big hairy goal. Mm-hmm. But there are many other things we're doing, ranging from superconducting qubits to NV centers, trying to link to the other hubs. So therefore thinking about communication problems as a kind of interface through to the sister hub, which is all about quantum communication and security. So it's an exciting thing to be part of.
So you're talking... So you say the Ion Trap system is a sort of the flagship system for ENCIT for quantum computing. The other systems you're working on, superconductors, NV, as you mentioned, is there the same kind of motivation that we want to build a quantum computer out of these systems? We have a design? Or is it more like we're just developing the technology for, say, the communications hub or the sensing hub? Other technology?
Exactly. Yeah. So these different qubit devices, you know, you can think of them in multiple different ways, from sensors to repeater systems for comms through to computing. But no, the primary thrust of the research, whether it is with ion traps or optical devices that might be used to link ion traps, but might be interesting in their own right, or superconducting systems or NV centers, the primary interest is in computing in each case. But of course, the researchers are well aware that that there may be these other opportunities, and the groups are often involved in other hubs. So a single group in the UK can be involved in more than one hub. And so you might might have a lab that's focusing on the communications implication of your stuff, and a lab that's focusing on the computing implications. But ENCIT itself is primarily focused around the computing side of things, which is, you know, the toughest goals, I guess, but also the ones that I think are the most exciting.
Well, I mean, the other thing that I wanted to ask you, especially with the hub program, and as you said, because it's so sort of coordinated and sort of entangled with industry, is sort of what we're seeing happening in the last, you know, 3 or 4 years, where we've now got major corporate players, whether it's the Googles, the IBMs, the Microsofts, whether it's the plethora of hardware startups, and there's what, 5-ish hardware startups at the moment?
Gosh, that's a lot. I think it's probably more than 5, but don't ask me which ones they are, because I'll just embarrass myself.
Just the hardware ones. Then there's the software startups, which is even more.
Yes.
And then you've got sort of these university consortiums and government consortiums. ENCIT be a good example, the hubs in general. Delft would be another good example. What's going on here in Sydney would be another good example. How does sort of the discussions that you have and the discussions that occur in the UK start negotiating this? Because certainly, you know, you and I never thought, at least, well, correct me if I'm wrong, I never really thought that it would happen this quickly.
I mean, it is really interesting on a more sort of almost political level, just where the field is going, right? So you and I as researchers, we like to spend most of our time thinking about solving the puzzle of how you get this qubit to do more or to talk to this other one. But if you kind of zoom out to the whole organizational level of things, it's so much more complex than it was even a couple of years ago. And when we pitched the hubs, we were needing to, it was a very short timescale for putting together the proposals, and we needed to call up a bunch of companies and basically pitch to them, would they like to be involved? Now, I tried to do a similar thing a couple of years before and got quite a sort of guarded reception. A lot of companies would say, yeah, we're kind of aware of the quantum thing, but we don't see it as relevant to us. It's not on our horizon. But then when we tried to put together the hub proposals, I was amazed at how positive the reception was. I don't think I got one, you know, it was pretty much having to cold call companies, right? And ring up their inquiries number and say, hi, I want to speak to your CTO. So it was interesting. But every time, we would hear, yeah, we're really into that. We'd be very interested to talk about that. Or even, yes, we've just hired someone who knows a bit about quantum and we're starting to put that together. So it was obvious that, you know, the mindset was changing. And now we're really seeing that, as you say, with major efforts by IBM, Google and Intel and so on to represent themselves to their investors and shareholders and the public as being in the business of producing quantum computers. And so the amount of investment that's going on is definitely exponentiating. There's also a lot of progress, and I think progress in terms of, you know, what the hardware is like and the software ideas is also very rapid at the moment. But it does worry me that the expectations which come with making an investment can run ahead of how fast the research and the, you know, the R&D can possibly go.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, I'm afraid, the way things tend to go with humans, right? Is that it's kind of a digital thing. Are you invested in and enthusiastic about topic X or not? And if you are, then you know you're right behind it. So as more people switch into being invested in quantum, you know, we get this bubble, or the risk is we get a bubble of investment that can not possibly have its expectations met on the timescale it wants. And this has happened to the AI community a few times, right? So now we all talk about how machine learning is going to power self-driving cars and is already in Amazon and Facebook and so on, how impressive it is. But the AI community had a couple of, as it were, false starts where people got too enthusiastic about what could be delivered too fast and thought that we were going to have robot butlers or whatever. And the investment kind of went up exponentially and then collapsed. And then I think the term that the researchers use is AI winter, which means not like it sounds like that's what happens after Skynet nukes everybody,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Winter. But the AI winter is merely the time of very difficult, you know, very difficult for researchers to obtain funding because they've just been through this cycle and now everybody thinks they're not investable. And they, you know, they went through at least two of those before getting to where they are now. And I was talking to an AI researcher, a machine learning guy, and he was saying that he's afraid we're in another one because even though it's all working now and Go programs, you know, beat the best players using AI techniques and, you know, self-driving cars will use this. And you think, how can they possibly go wrong at this stage? You still can, because people can overinvest and they can think it's going to happen faster than it will. And it would be lovely if we can avoid that in quantum technology, if we can just moderate the enthusiasm, which is wonderful to see, with realistic expectations, so that we can have some kind of continual funding trajectory and genuinely get to quantum computers as fast as possible. But I'm a little bit of a pessimist on that. I think that it may be almost unavoidable that people just overinvest and then there's a correction. Let's call it a bit less, you know, than a mm-hmm. winter, but a correction. Where, you know, what would that mean in the current language? It would mean that a lot of startups that we're seeing would shut down. I mean, startups naturally have a, you know, a high kind of culling rate, but, you know, that suddenly the investment would drive. And that would be a shame because there's a lot of fantastic startups out there. So that's why I try and fight back a bit against people promising too much too soon, or even just terminology like quantum supremacy that seems to be liable to overexcite investors. But there's also, by the way, I mean, you listed quite a good list of different things, but one shouldn't forget that the EU has decided that quantum will be their next flagship project. So the EU has, you know, at given time, one flagship project, which is a kind of decided to be the big research challenge for at least 5 years. And quantum is going to be that one. So that implies an investment of the order of €1 billion into Europe to achieve that.
Well, I think so, I also saw a picture of a slide from Squint, one of the conferences that's going on in the States at the moment. And it looks as though this US quantum initiative is at least fairly close to getting up as well.
Really? Yeah. I mean, there is a kind of... So the UK was probably the first, although the Netherlands was also, I mean, of course, Australia, for example, has been, you know, investing as quite a national priority for a long time. So has Singapore and so on. But in terms of like a big new effort that like, right, we're going to prioritize this and put a ton of money in it. The UK did it. The Netherlands did it. And it's really happening all over the place. And again, I think there is a kind of, you don't want to be behind the other country, right? So it's kind of persuasive to see that other people are making large investments, which is great for us right now in the field. But we do need to be careful what we promise, I think, because as long as people know what they're getting into, and quantum computing is just this enormously exciting, all of quantum technology is this enormously exciting new level to technology. But we do also need to be careful. It needs to be said, for example, that we don't have many quantum algorithms properly worked out that we can be really hand on heart sure would be beneficial to, you know, outside of code breaking and physics problems. Now, there's no reason to be worried about that because we don't have the computers yet to play with. But it does need to be said. You will find people who have spent a while reading into quantum computing and still have the idea that quantum computers will just be overwhelmingly better at everything. And that, you know, that's certainly wrong, as you and I know very well. You know, there's things that quantum computers just won't even help with. So it's all about enjoying the time we're in now and this flowering and rush to actually achieve real machines, and a lot of physicists becoming involved in startups and saying, right, let's just make this happen. Super exciting. But I hope that it's still super exciting in 5 years' time, and it isn't judged that we've overpromised, and then we kind of have a hostile environment, and we all have to scrimp and get by until the curve starts to, you know, rise again.
I think we can all touch wood for that one.
Yeah,
I completely agree. Well, I mean, we're getting close to an hour now. That conversation actually moved on quite rapidly. I didn't actually notice. But as usual, especially because, you know, you represent a pretty interesting and a fascinating organization in this kind of field. Is there anything happening, anything you want to promote, anything you want to spruik out for people who may be listening?
Yeah, I should have given thought to that question before we started speaking. I think that it's been, well, the NKIT thing, a thing to say about that is it's an open structure whereby actually all four of the hubs were required to put some of their initial investment essentially in a bank account, 10%. So we had something of the order of 4 million in a bank account where you can't access it to fund your own research. You can't say, oh crap, we didn't buy enough lasers for the ion trap lab, let's just dig into that extra fund. The purpose of it is to make new things happen. So we need to be approached by typically academics who are also talking to some industry, and they say to us, you know, like, we know what you're doing in the hub, here's something that's a little bit different, but still under the heading of quantum computing. Would you be interested in partnering with us on that? And then we have some money to help make that happen. So it's, of course, not just we don't just give people money. It has to be synergistic with what we're doing, and the companies involved have to put their share in. But we can grow and extend and rejuvenate even what we're doing continuously. And so that the reason I'm saying that is if there are people listening who are thinking, well, what about the stuff I'm doing on quantum computing? I wonder if that's aligned with what NKIT wants to do, then they should basically get in touch, because we're always keen to see more of those things happen, bring in more academics and more commercial interest. And then so that's on the more organizational level. And then just on the research level, I think something we're not going to want to get into now, but I just want to sort of flag it up that I think it's super interesting. And we did skirt around this is what are the thoughts we can have about how we're going to minimize the impact of errors in small quantum computers, or if you want to use John Preskill's term, intermediate scale, meaning more than 50 bits, in the regime where it might be useful, but as you said, it might also be that we can't fit a useful algorithm in without it getting overwhelmed by errors. So the kind of things that people talk about are hybrid algorithms where a shallow, as in not many operations, quantum circuit is run, then the information goes back to a classical supervising computer, and then the quantum computer is used again in a short burst. And this happens over and over again. And then that way we kind of short burst our way to an interesting solution. Those kind of ideas for those algorithms, and also tricks and tactics and ideas for crushing down on the way errors build up, whilst accepting that we're not going to be able to get rid of them comprehensively, because that requires the full and expensive machinery of quantum error correction. So what you might call some error mitigation and resilient algorithms, I think that's super interesting. And in terms of, you know, that I'd like to sort of wave a flag to say, along with many other groups, my group is focusing on that. And that's what I love to talk to people about.
Well, I'll definitely put the links to your group and your email and everything down there. Anyone who's interested, anyone who wants to work on this for a couple of years, I would definitely encourage them to contact you and consider NKIT in Oxford as a place to go.
Yeah, well, great. Thank you very much.
Wonderful.
It's been a lot of fun talking to you. And, you know, it's good to get these ideas out there and to also maybe, you know, sound these notes of caution.
No, I completely agree. And this is why we always try and get on a large range of people. And certainly, you know, this was one of the easiest conversations I've ever had to do, because I think your research aligns with my research quite nicely. I don't have to think about it too much. We're on the same page in a lot of things.
Yeah, I think so. There's probably someone with very different ideas out there, like going, no, no. But,
that's but, all yeah, right. They're not named Simon, so that's fine.
That's right. That's yeah. right.
So anyway, thank you all again for tuning in on this podcast. I should hopefully have the next episode up pretty soon. I have got a list of people that have agreed to do it, and I'm trying to rattle through the episodes as quickly as possible and upload them. But thank you all for your patience again. And as I've always said, I will try to make this year a little bit more dense. But keep tuning in, keep sharing it, and we'll have more diverse people on to talk about what they're doing in the field of quantum technology. So thanks again, and thank you again, Simon, for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you.
Cheers.